This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The beer is warm, the pretzels are stale. It must mean, yep, first round of presidential debates is over. Let the spin begin. Last night, President George Bush and Senator John Kerry defined their positions on foreign policy and homeland security. So does any of that affect North Carolina? Steve Green, political science professor at North Carolina State University, is here to help us parse it out. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to tell you what we think. You tell us what you think. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. If you had your mind changed, if you saw anything in that debate that gave you pause, or if you just want to talk about what you saw, 877-962-9862. We'll talk about the debate first. And just to let you know, if you're interested in talking politics or what you saw in the debate, we're going to take care of that early in the program. Later on, we'll talk with Ellen Gilchrist, the writer and winner of the Thomas Wolfe Prize. So if things literary are your preference, you might want to hang on for later in the program and give us a call then. Kathy Eldon is also with us. She's executive producer of a documentary film about her son, Dan Eldon, who died in Somalia. He's a photographer and was killed then. That's later in the program, and we invite your calls for that. But right now, it is about the debate, and Steve Green is here. Steve, do you get the sense that anything happened last night that could have changed the mind of an undecided voter?
Yes, I do, actually, in that I think... you know, the pressure was really on Kerry. There's a lot of people who are unhappy with the direction of the country, don't feel so good about Iraq, but for whatever reason don't feel that they can necessarily commit to a vote for Kerry at this point. And from what I saw and from what the polls seem to show, he made a pretty good case last night that may indeed win over some of those uncommitted voters.
How do you suppose that happened? Was it any particular answer? Was it a particular question that may have tipped the balance?
I think it was just kind of the consistency of his message that, no, I'm not a flip-flopper, that this has been my consistent position. You know, and it's not necessarily the easiest thing for him to explain, but I think he did fairly well. And you know, that was his point that he was going to stick to, that he in fact is not the flip-flopper that Bush says. And then his other point of trying to question Bush's judgment on matters that he continually got in there.
You know, the interesting thing to me was that he was given the opportunity to give a consistent message about how he felt about Iraq by the president, who frequently came back to the same point that uncertainty is not what we need right now. That was a question or an answer the president often gave to questions that weren't particularly directed at that.
Right.
But it seemed to give John Kerry the opportunity to say over and over again, "No, I am consistent."
Yeah. I mean, he certainly did. But you know, that was the president's strategy, is, you know, to say John Kerry is inconsistent, is sending mixed messages, or keeps changing positions. And, you know, he had to know that Kerry was going to try and rebut these things. But, you know, I think it's a matter of hoping that his message sticks with the viewing public better than Kerry's does.
Anything about this format? One of the things John Kerry is accused of course, is being perhaps a bit too detailed, a little bit too long-winded, doesn't quite get to the point in the way the president is famous for.
Right.
But he's got 2 minutes, so is there anything about the compressed schedule that may have worked in Kerry's favor in this?
I think you have an interesting point there. I think being, you know, knowing going in that he was not going to have longer than 2 minutes, and on a rebuttal, 90 seconds on any given answer, you know, and I heard he went through several mock debates and did a lot of practice, you know, I'm sure helped force him to get his talking points down into that much more digestible format that seems to work with the electorate.
Let's bring it to North Carolina. Kerry said he wanted to double the number of special forces in the U.S. military. What does that mean for North Carolina?
I guess it means more troops from North Carolina are heading to Iraq. Well, I mean, if Kerry were to be president.
Yeah, and I guess part of that message was that we needed more troops overall, so not that all that would be sent to Iraq, but that we'd be prepared to take on challenges elsewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's go to the phones. Pete is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Pete.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good.
First off, as a somewhat biased Democrat, I was pretty thrilled with Kerry's performance last night, and I think the president showed the true depth of his abilities there. Anyway, I had a bigger question, though, and this is one I've never really seen addressed. Has anyone ever looked historically at the conservative movement, and have they ever proven to be right? I mean, we look back to the Revolution. We had the conservatives, the Tories, all the way up through the 60s. The conservatives were the against integration, against a lot of the more progressive things that we now consider to be the right path. When have they ever been right? When have they ever been correct in their fight, this conservative thing? I didn't state that very well.
Well, I guess thank you for your question, Pete. Is there a way we can get at that, Steve? Certainly there are conservatives who say they've been right all along. We're just not listening. That, you know, you're just not listening if you don't get the message.
Yeah, I'm sure that that conservatives would respond that you know, you can look at a number of things in recent years, and they can say that liberals have gone too far. And you look at policies in the past 20 years, really starting with Reagan, that have, say, taken powers away from the federal government, given them back to the states. And, you know, just the fact that people have bought into this idea, so many people have bought into this idea that the federal government has too much influence in people's lives, and getting the government off people's backs would suggest, you know, at least from the conservative viewpoint, that you know, liberals, the conservatives had been right.
Yeah, and Newt Gingrich and his supporters will tell you that the contract with America saved the country. So
even though none of it was actually put into law, but very little.
Mike is on the line from Wake Forest. Hello, Mike.
Hi there. The rules prevented the two candidates from interacting with each other, and I think that Jim Lehrer was allowed to, and I think that there's a changing point in the entire presentation when he made them interact by stopping one and asking the other one to respond to what he had just said. And I think that raised the intensity of the debate and actually made it well worth watching, which we'd all been led to believe that it wasn't going to be worth watching at all. And I also thought it pretty amazing that President Bush would run out of things to say and would stop repeating himself over and over again when we had time left to keep talking. I thought that was pretty revealing.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
For that observation, it did seem a bit more interactive, even though they didn't speak directly to each other. There was a sense that they were responding directly to each other's challenges.
Yeah, I would have to agree. As a fan of American democracy, you know, I think one has to be pretty happy with how this debate turned out, because there was a, you know, a lot of cynical pre-debate coverage about just kind of parallel press conferences and whatnot. But I would say, you know, there's some real genuine engagement with each other that was certainly useful, and I do agree that the moderator Jim Lehrer did a good job of trying to make things where there were clear differences between the candidates, make sure that, you know, they were very clear on that, so that the viewers could be clear on that.
Yeah, I think that was extremely helpful to say exactly what you said. Look, are we clear? Did I hear you just say? And allow both candidates to either validate that or clarify. Let's go to Jack on the line from Durham. Hi, Jack.
Yes, I was just kind of astounded at one moment last night when Bush asserted that the problem with the situation in Iraq is that we won the war too fast. And I'm just wondering why no one has really followed up on that, and what he, if you could speculate as to what he actually meant. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Steve, you do the speculating.
Okay. Well, I thought that was interesting to me, as when I was taking notes during the debate, that was one part where I marked down that it seemed like Bush really kind of struggled with that, and that it was interesting, and they asked him, you know, what miscalculations happened. And it reminded me a lot of that this press conference back, was, it must have been 6 months ago or something like that, when they said, somebody asked him, you know, what mistakes have you made? And he seems to have a lot of trouble dealing with questions like that. And, you know, nobody wants to admit mistakes, and I think President Bush perhaps more than most. And so it was just kind of this way out of saying, you know, actually trying to claim that one of your strengths is a mistake. You know, oh, my mistake was, you know, underestimating the great power of the U.S. military, sort of thing. So,
well, it seems to me one of the underlying questions in the debate, and one of the defining differences between the two, is sort of what do you do? And I think the president's suggestion, what sort of message does that send when you ask the question? What do you do if you had found you made a mistake? Would it be okay at any point to challenge the administration, to challenge American policy with troops on the ground, if you had discovered you made a mistake? And the implication from the White House seems to be, well, we can't expose that right away because we have troops on the ground. What John Kerry seems to be saying is, we have troops on the ground, we have to expose that right away.
Right. And again, just from my perspective as a, let's say, a fan of American democracy, you know, a free and open debate, and, you know, certainly you do not want to undermine what's going on with American lives at risk. But if our policies are putting American lives at more risk than they need to be or should be, that's certainly something that should be part of the domestic discussion here.
Now we have time for one more question. Greg is in Burlington. Greg?
Yes. Hello. I'm sorry I'm in my car, but two quick comments. I am a Kerry supporter, and I think that the senator should have made a large point about when they were talking about proliferation of nuclear weapons, and Bush was hammering especially about in the hands of terrorists. When Kerry was talking about how our borders are not secure, our container ships are not secure, I think he could have had a very good point about bringing up a suitcase-type bomb or a tactical weapon-type bomb, small, that we must do more with our security around our ports, our rail stations, bus stations. That's one point. The other point is that I think that Senator Kerry could have hammered home about exactly what's going on in Iraq today and referring to the two Republican senators, Hagel and McCain, who just about a week to 10 days ago, Hagel said that we are not winning the war right now in Iraq, and Senator McCain said that President Bush should be more forthright.
All right, Greg, we'll have time for a real quick response. Thanks.
I think Kerry has been bringing up that issue that Bush hasn't been doing enough for Homeland Security, and you know Bush responds, well, we've raised these funds here, and you know I guess it's just an issue with which you know most people just don't feel they really know enough about that. It doesn't seem to make much difference in helping Kerry, so it seems.
All right, Steve Green, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Green, political science professor at North Carolina State University, spoke with us today. Just ahead, a prolific writer, Ellen Gilchrist, this year's winner of the Thomas Wolfe Prize. And if you have some questions, call us at 877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Washington Post book critic Jonathan Yardley describes writer Ellen Gilchrist this way. To say that Ellen Gilchrist can write is to say that Placido Domingo can sing. The Thomas Wolfe Society agrees and has chosen Ellen Gilchrist as this year's winner of the Thomas Wolfe Prize for her contribution to writing in the humanities. Ellen Gilchrist is a Southerner, born in Mississippi, attended Vanderbilt University, and later enrolled in a creative writing course at Millsaps College that was taught by Eudora Welty. She has given us many eccentric characters whose off-kilter lives move us from the mundane to the traumatic, with often shocking endings. But Ellen Gilchrist didn't start to write until she was in her mid-40s, published her first book of poetry in 1979, first collection of short stories in 81, first novel in 83. 1 year later, Victory Over Japan, a collection of short stories, won the National Book Award for Fiction. Ellen Gilchrist currently teaches creative writing at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. Her 23rd book is one about her teaching experiences in Arkansas. That comes out next spring. And Ellen Gilchrist joins us on the line now from Fayetteville. Welcome.
Hello. Can you hear me? Do our listeners know that I'm talking on a telephone?
They know that you're talking on a telephone, and they're delighted to hear you any way they can. And they can talk to you by speaking to us at 877-962-9862, which I bet you didn't know.
No.
And cared less about.
I didn't know that people
number.
Were going to call in.
They're calling us right now, as a matter of fact. On the 800 line, you have won the Thomas Wolfe Prize. It's quite an honor. You're following in the footsteps of Pat Conroy, Elizabeth Spence, Tom Wolfe.
Elizabeth Spence.
Yeah, Elizabeth Spence. Yeah, Tom Wolfe. Do you see a relationship between your writing and Thomas Wolfe?
No, but I know that I've read all of Thomas Wolfe's books when I was very young, much too young to understand what I was reading in any intellectual sense, but I read all the time when I was a child, and I was fascinated by him. I remember beginning Look Homeward at Angel and getting up. I must have been 16, you know, way too young to really understand that kind of literature. But I remember thinking, this is just like real life. This is just like real people. Being astounded by that. And then later I was fascinated by all the legends about how he would take boxes of papers to New York and Malcolm Cowley or whoever it was would turn it into books.
Kind of, it leads to an interesting question as you say that. You say you're sort of too young to get kind of the deeper literary meaning, but there was something about reading that kept you hooked, that kept you reading. What makes a good reader? Do readers have to start young? Should they start with good literature, or is there anything that, or do we just
labels? They need to do something that probably isn't possible anymore, and that's live in a house with no television and a lot of very interesting adults, all of whom read all the time in their spare time. Anytime I looked around, you know, my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, my aunts, anyone I knew. I mean, my father might be reading different things, or my grandfather might be reading, you know, magazines that like Country Gentleman or something for farmers. He ran a cotton plantation. But they were always reading, and this seemed to me like what adults did, and I wanted to be an adult. Mm-hmm. All intelligent children want to be an adult because they don't want to be in the powerless position of being a child any longer than they can help being in that position. So I think so I always read, and also people read to me. But very quickly, before I went to school, I knew how to read, and I didn't want them to read to me. I wanted to read to myself. Mm-hmm.
You're giving a lecture in Chapel Hill next week. What are you going to talk about?
Well, it's not actually a lecture, because one thing that Eudora Welty taught me is the University of Virginia asked her to give the graduation speech, and she said, oh, I don't give advice. And they said, well, would you read something that you've written? And she said, yes. So I tried giving advice sometimes when I was young and would go to colleges, but I think I'll just read from my work and answer questions. I'd love to think that I'm a philosopher and an intellectual, but I'm not really. You know, I'm a writer.
Well, what we think of good writers as those who can bring us to the philosophy and intellection in our own lives, so
right.
There's something behind it. But I guess you're getting a bit at the process. What do you look at? What is it that helps you begin a story? Do you start with the story, the details of a life, or is there something more intellectual about it that you want to get at?
That's definitely not intellectual. It's exactly like having imaginary playmates, which I had. I mean, intellectually, I suppose when you're young, but I didn't start writing when I was 45. I wrote all my life. I had a newspaper column in a real newspaper when I was in high school. I just didn't start seriously and professionally writing and publishing until after my children were teenagers, you know, because I was involved in life. I would just write things, but then I'd go back to my real life. But I didn't start doing it real seriously and professionally and concentrating on learning how to get it published and things like that until I was about 40.
I'm always suspicious when I read things like that, especially about a great writer, because the thought is, well, they must have been writing all this time, even if they hadn't had any thought about publishing.
No, and I did publish. I published a lot of poetry. And at different times in my life, in different places, I published a lot of poetry. And almost any, you know, and I won awards whenever I'd write. I just didn't have it for an avocation, I suppose, until I was older.
I'm talking with writer Ellen Gilchrist this hour. The number is 877-962-9862 if you want to join the conversation. Is it a different process for you when you write poetry than, say, moving to short story or a novel?
I didn't answer your question, and it was an interesting one, about how I began to write something.
Yeah.
It's an act of the imagination. The imagination gives that to anyone who's read a lot and knows how to write. And your imagination gives it to you probably as a huge movie or a scenario, or it gives you a lot at once. It doesn't just give you some little piece of something. It gives you an idea, and it's a big idea. And then you begin to put it into words. You go alone into a quiet place and begin with a pencil or a pen or a typewriter or whatever you use to translate that gift from the imagination into words.
Does it come
and
to you?
I don't know how to explain that any better than that. And I know how to title. I know where to start because I try to teach my students, any place you start is as good as it. Just the first thing your mind gives you in language, start with that.
So in a way, you're sort of editing yourself. Once you get those first words on paper, you're not writing anymore. I guess you're editing.
No, I'm just writing very, very fast. I can edit it tomorrow.
When you talked about this sort of movie, this big idea, appearing before you. Do you see the end of the movie at the same moment? Do you know how it's going
to end? I don't know. If you saw the ending, you wouldn't have to write the story of the book to find out what happened.
So you're surprised by your characters and surprised by your stories as well, as you're writing.
I'm not surprised. I just sort of follow them. I make a living doing this.
Yeah. I don't mean surprised by the success, but I mean, I wonder if a character has ever surprised you. If you thought they were headed in one direction and all of a sudden they do something, because as you're writing this thing, you realize, oh, no, they wouldn't do that. They would do this.
Not any more than real people surprise one by their actions and behaviors and choices. Actually, once you know somebody, whether they're real or whether they're an imaginary playmate or an imaginary character, once you know that person, you're not really surprised by anything that they do. Most of the things that people do, you think, God, that's just like her.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that?
You do.
Or I knew she'd get into that.
But you present us some interesting characters who start out very familiar to us. I'm thinking in particular of, say, Nora Jane, who appears in a number of your stories. And she's quite familiar doing very ordinary things until she robs bars and sort of makes a living at disguising herself and doing in a very calm and ordinary way things that I didn't expect she'd do when you introduced me to her.
My father was always very concerned about that story. It irritated him to death that someone, a well-raised person who'd been educated and loved by good people, would write about someone committing a robbery. That's why I had her rob a bar, and her mother's an alcoholic, so she thinks that people that sell alcohol should be punished in any way possible at the time when she, I mean, she thinks that's, beyond her Catholic upbringing.
Mm-hmm. But it was,
I justified it for.
You justified it. But that apparently didn't clear you in the eyes of your father.
No, it did not. I was really irritated that I would write a story about someone committing a robbery.
877-962-9862, the number to call. If you'd like to join our guest, Ellen Gilchrist. Lisa's on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I wanted to call and speak because I love your writing.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for writing it. And I've read you for years and years, and I go back to your stories and back to the Annunciation again and again, especially, I think, in times when I need comfort in life. It's almost like comfort food to me.
Oh, what a lovely thing to say. That makes me happy.
Well, it's true. And I want, and I love all of your characters. I wondered if you had a favorite character, or if you love them all equally.
It's sometimes a character will sort of be not my favorite, but I'll be interested in them. But when I'm writing about them, whichever one I'm writing about is the one that interests me. But I like them all. I chose them just like I choose my friends out of the whole world of the imagination. And I wish that Anna Hand, my character in North Carolina, had to kill herself because she had cancer before they could treat it properly. I wish that Anna wasn't dead, because I would love to write about Anna. And right now I'm writing about Anna's niece, Louise Hand's daughter, Louise.
So you're bringing the family into the picture. Well, thank you for your call, Lisa. Ellen, do you have characters you just don't like?
No. I leave them in my story if I don't like them. Actually, there's a short story called Rich that was the first story in the Land of Dreamy Dreams,
mm-hmm.
and a man kills a dog and a child in it, mm-hmm. and that story made me famous. When I first wrote it was all published everywhere, and I only wrote it because I was in this workshop, and the director of the workshop challenged me to write a horrible ending, and I did it. But when I made my collected stories, I left that out of my stories. because I don't want my 13 grandchildren or my great-grandchild to read that story. I would never know or like anybody that would do something like that, even if he was mentally deranged. So I wish I hadn't written it.
So you think about your readers as you're writing?
No. Sometimes, a long time ago, when I'd be writing a story, I'd almost have a target audience in mind, and it would be some specific friend of mine that I knew would think it was funny.
Okay.
You know, if it was something funny, I'd think, oh, boy, Tom's going to really get a kick out of this or something like that. But I just try to be a good typist. Well, for my imagination.
Well, it's more than typing in your case, Ellen Gilchrist. 877-962-9862, the number to call. But it does raise the question, when I heard you say that, you know, sort of concern about whether or not you'd want somebody, your kids, or somebody to be reading about this kind of thing.
I didn't think about that when I was younger. I didn't have all these fabulous grandchildren that I worship.
But doesn't it impose a bit on your imagination, restrict it a bit if you're worried about the impact of the writing?
No, because I didn't write things. I only wrote, that's the only story, and then another story about suicides that was based on a true story out that I heard in Seattle that haunted me. But those are the only things. But, you know, I wouldn't, I don't consciously think that way. I just, that's just about the work that I did when I was much younger.
Well, Ellen, Kathy is on the line from Greensville. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question that I guess it's a little different. As a child, I know I was born a reader and a writer, but by the time I reached 9 years old, there were five kids. We were on in a family of tenant farmers and a father that would go from place to place, and we moved 13 times before I was 9 years old, and it was always when I would try to read, my dad would punish me and say, you need to be doing housework and not wasting your time reading. And he had a fifth grade education. And but anyway, as time went on and I was going through school, and all I did was basically what I had to do in school to make my grades. And then real life started happening. I had to take care of myself and survive. And now I've reached age over 40, closer to 50, and I've just started making myself write again. I've written in a journal along the way, but I just find it that I don't have, I'm having a difficult time putting things into words that are in my imagination, and I'm finding myself going to the real life experiences but wanting to put them in the form of fiction. And the only way I've really gotten back into reading again is through the Oprah Club. Thank God she got me started reading again. I've been reading some books that I never thought that I would ever read. And I'm looking forward to reading some of your work since I've not read those. But my question is, when you get to a point in your life that you're at this age, do you think that it's possible... I've been looking into the publishing situation, and it's just very complex at times. And I just wondered if you think that it's still possible at this age and having that type of life where it's held you back so much from not reading, if you'd still be capable of publishing.
I don't know. What a wonderful and haunting story. You know what I think you should do?
What's that?
I think you should stop worrying about publishing and just write for fun until you see what happens. Turn yourself free to write.
Okay.
Just say to yourself, no one's ever going to see this. I can write anything I want.
Okay.
And then you'll write, and then maybe it'll be easier for you. And I definitely think you need to read William Faulkner. If you are the child of a tenant farmer, one of 10 children who moved from place to place, you need to read William Faulkner. It's hard to read. It's like reading Shakespeare if you don't know how. You'll have to do it out loud until you get the cadences. You may have to have a dictionary by your side.
Yeah.
Read Go Down Moses, and for goodness sakes, read the Snopes trilogy, The Town, The Hamlet, and The Mansion. You will just, I think, Eudora Welty writing changed when she began to read Faulkner. She worshipped him. And you should read Eudora Welty also. You should read and write and turn yourself free to write. And don't worry about publishing. Thinking about publishing and worrying about publishing can ruin all the fun.
Well, I guess it's because I'm in a stage where I'm needing money. And
well, you're not going to make any money as a writer.
Yes.
It's just right up there with playing slot machines.
Okay.
All right, Kathy. Thank you so much for your call. You told us about Eudora Welty, and of course you were a student. How well did you know her?
I knew her, I thought, very, very well, and it meant a lot to me. She only taught once in her life, at a time when her mother was dying. Her friends at Millsaps College in the English department convinced her to come and teach. She needed the money, and she needed the human intercourse that she found with us. And we were just, you know, 20 hand-picked students, if that many. I think maybe there were 16, really. And we worshipped her and we loved her. And it was a time in her life when she hadn't published anything in a while, and a sad time in her life with family, people in her family dying. And I think we meant a lot to her, and we knew it. And she treated us like we actually could possibly be writers.
Gave you the confidence to go forward.
Well, we just loved her. We just liked being in her presence.
Well, we like you being in our presence, and thank you very much for joining us, Ellen Gilchrist. This year's winner of the Thomas Wolfe Prize, Ellen Gilchrist, will be giving the annual Thomas Wolfe Lecture next Wednesday, October 6th, 7:30 p.m., Carroll Hall on the campus of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The event is free and open to the public. Just ahead, we'll talk to Kathy Eldon, whose film Dying to Tell the Story documents the life of her son, who died in 1993, covering the events in Mogadishu's Somalia. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1993, Dan Eldon was working as a photographer for Reuters news agency in Mogadishu, Somalia. On July 12th of that year, he was killed by an angry mob while on assignment. Dan Eldon was 22 years old. In 1998, his mother, Kathy Eldon, and his sister, Amy, made a documentary called Dying to Tell the Story about Dan and other reporters who put their lives on the line to cover wars and conflict zones around the world. The documentary screens at 2 this afternoon on the UNC Chapel Hill campus. It's part of a journalism and trauma seminar. Kathy Eldon joins us now in the studio. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you tell us how your son was killed?
There was a bombing by UN forces of a house where they believed that General Idid, who was the warlord at the time, the sort of Osama bin Laden of the time, was hiding. As it happened, it was a peace meeting with elders and men, and women were serving them and children were playing in the courtyard. So tragically, there were about 74 people killed and 200 people wounded. When the survivors ran to the journalist's hotel to get the journalists, begged them to come, and the journalists said, look, we'll only come if we're guaranteed safety, and they were, of course, guaranteed safety. They arrived at the site of this horrific carnage and started shooting what had happened, and the people were so enraged that a mob formed, and they killed 4 journalists. So they killed the very people that were trying to help them.
Trying to cover. And, of course, this was the time in Somalia. This is the events that preceded the Black Hawk Down episode. And it was a very dangerous time and a lawless time in Somalia. Now, at this time, you had already been a filmmaker, an author, and a journalist yourself before Dan was killed. Did it seem like the natural thing to do at the time, to do a documentary about this?
Actually, really almost from the second that Dan was killed that I found out, I felt that these lives should not be in vain. And in fact, when the head of Reuters called me, just as a sort of courtesy call, I said, his name is Mark Wood, I said, Mark, we have to do something to make these lives mean something, because there were 4 of them. It wasn't just about Dan, it was about 4 journalists' lives. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately, I worked with the Associated Press and Reuters to try to create events that would create awareness of journalists at risk. And in fact, one of the very first ones was at the Terry Sanford School of Public Policy here at Duke University, and we got Tom Brokaw to come down, who was a Duke University graduate, to come and speak. And in those early conferences, they started to really focus on issues that are now really out there in the public, but then were really quite unknown, about press safety, about the role of freelancers not having insurance, about organizations really protecting their people. So that, to me, was the first thing that I did. But I really wanted to try to make a feature film that would draw attention to the role of young or journalists, not young journalists, journalists at war. And so I moved to Hollywood from I was living in London. I moved to LA to try and make a feature. And I'll say 11 years later, we were almost there. But the documentary is another whole story. But we're hoping very much to make a proper film, you know, feature film about journalists.
Feature film as well. Well, let's hear a clip from the documentary that gives us a sense of what it's like to be working in a war zone.
The way to start in this business is to get a one-way ticket to hell and stay there long enough to tell the story. A still photographer or a cameraman has to be there. You've got to be really close to what's happening, you've got to be really close to the pictures. And because it's so intimate, it's also very dangerous.
There's no way you can hide behind the camera because you're looking through it. And somehow when you look through the camera, you feel even closer to the person you're photographing.
It's a fascinating line of work, I'm telling you, to be able to be in these situations where you see humanity at its extremes.
It's a profession, it's a mission, it's public service, it's commitment, it's sacrifice.
Some of us have to use our pens, some of us have to use our cameras to bring down the system.
My job is to record what's there. I would like people to be curious, to become, maybe pass on my curiosity of something they've seen that I photographed.
We're licensed idiots who go out and stand in the line of fire and earn our living there.
If there's no picture, there's no story. You might as well not have been there.
It's an excerpt from the documentary Dying to Tell the Story. The film's executive producer, Kathy Eldon, is my guest. The film tells the story of Dan Eldon, Kathy's son, who was killed while on assignment for Reuters news agency in Somalia. And those are a number of journalists who have been in various situations painting a picture of a very dangerous profession.
Yeah, and I'd like to clarify that the film follows Dan's journey. My daughter Amy, who was 21 at the time, 22 when she did the film, follows Dan's journey, but it's really a film about the profession. Dan's is only one of the seven stories intertwined in that, so it's not just about Dan.
But it really does take a look at, as you say, sort of how dangerous this was. This was Dan's first assignment, right? First overseas assignment?
Yes, actually, Dan was brought up in Kenya. We lived, I'm from Iowa, I'm American, but I married an Englishman, moved to London, and then my family and I moved to Kenya in 1977, where I became a journalist. So Dan was trailing along beside me on a lot of my assignments and actually did a lot of the photography. In 1991, he and a friend went up to southern Somalia because there was a famine that was brewing there. Mm-hmm. And Dan took photographs, which became among the first to alert the world to that tragedy. And he went back time and time again, utterly moved, devastated, horrified, transfixed by the unfolding devastation there.
And the documentary does more than just document the dangerous work of photojournalists and others in hot zones like that. It also sort of asks the question, why? Why do they do it?
That is a good question. I, as a journalist myself, you do it, I think, initially because of a sense of mission. Some people get hooked on the adrenaline. Some people forget their mission entirely. It can wreak havoc on individuals, certainly. I might point out that from that program, we have two people have died. One of the people you played just now, Carlos Mavrilian, died in Afghanistan. He was sneaking over the border to cover someone who was totally unknown at the time, named Osama bin Laden. And he died in 1998 of very mysterious circumstances, and many people believe he was murdered. The other person was Mohammed Shafi, who died in the year 2000 while covering the Jerusalem elections. And he died of a massive heart attack at the age of 49, which I think was work-related.
And he was one of the survivors of the attack in Mogadishu.
Yeah, and a third person, David Gutenfelder, was shot at, and the person sitting next to him in the vehicle died, and David lived, but with injuries. So three people out of our film of seven people were either dead or seriously injured.
I want to listen to another moment in the film. This clip starts actually with Mohammed Shafi, who you just talked about, and he was Dan's friend, the only journalist to survive the attack. They had gone to cover the bombing, as you said, with the by UN forces, and 70 civilians were killed. Just to recap, those journalists arrived, and the crowd turned on them.
Dan was behind me. Dan said, "Babuji, let's get out of here." I can still hear his voice up to today. And I said, "Fine." I took the camera off my shoulder and I said, "Run." They all ran. As soon as I was turned back, that's where I was thrown on the ground, pushed on the ground, and I was attacked by the mob.
The crowd turned hostile. Some of the other cars realized that and pulled out. And our car, the Reuters car, backed away. So when Dan came out, the Reuters vehicle was a lot further away than it had been when he'd been dropped there. And as he tried to get to the car, the crowd turned nasty.
The hardest situation to deal with is a frenzied mob, because they cannot be reasoned with. I try to appeal to one or two of the most sympathetic and restrained-looking people with the most effective-looking assault rifles. But I've realized that no photograph is worth my life or any other part of my body.
Again, an excerpt from Dying to Tell the Story, a documentary by executive producer Kathy Eldon, who is with us. And the last voice we heard is an actor reading from your son Dan's journal. And we put the question to you earlier, and we talked about other things, but why do you think Dan did this? Why did he take up this profession?
I think Dan really cared about the plight of the Somalis. I think he also found it very exciting to be covering a news story that was getting play. His photographs were center spread of Newsweek, Time magazine, Herald Tribune. You're a media person. There's something so exciting about knowing that what you're doing is making a difference. It's making an impact. It may not even be making a difference. It's very frustrating when what you're trying to communicate is relegated to a back page or not even shown at all. And I think during the time that he was in Somalia, he became very disillusioned. And I think because things were not shifting, they weren't getting better, they were getting worse. It's very parallel in a way to what's happening in Iraq right now, where well-intended actions don't always have the right outcome, what we think should be the right outcome. And what we're doing in Iraq, in a way, you know, often bombing or mortaring houses, and there are civilians and children who are consequences of war. It's very hard, and it's hard to watch this stuff on television. It's hard to read it in the newspaper.
Did you worry about him when he was out there, when he was in Somalia?
Absolutely. I'm a mom. I was worried. But I had such enormous faith in him. He was streetwise in Africa. I figured he could take care of himself. But when it got really bad and there were 19 Pakistanis killed, I said, "Don't you think it's time to get out?"
Kathy Eldon is executive producer of the documentary film Dying to Tell the Story. It will be screened this afternoon at 2 on the UNC campus. There will be a discussion and questions and answers with Kathy Eldon after the screening. Kathy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On February 1st, 1960, four black students from North Carolina A&T sat down at the whites-only Woolworth's lunch counter in downtown Greensboro. They waited for service, but the waitress behind the counter ignored them. The rest of the country took notice. The small step toward integration in Greensboro made front-page headlines in the New York Times and touched off the sit-in movement in the South. Commentator Justin Catanoso hopes this history will inform the current effort to improve race relations in Greensboro.
Given its Quaker heritage and ties to the start of the sit-in movement, Greensboro enjoys a historical legacy of tolerance and support for civil rights. The city is now testing those core values to see if it can accomplish what many cities in America choose to ignore: improved relations between blacks and whites. This complex effort is following two tracks that aren't exactly parallel. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, formed in June, seeks once and for all to better understand the city's and police department's role in the bloody November 1979 confrontation between Ku Klux Klansmen, Nazi sympathizers, and anti-KKK demonstrators. That clash left five people dead in a Greensboro housing project. Commission advocates insist that until the truth is fully explored and city leaders offer a genuine apology, then quarter-century-old wounds cannot be healed. Meanwhile, Greensboro Mayor Keith Holliday has just launched what he calls the Greensboro Bicentennial Mosaic Partnerships. This three-year initiative seeks to pair hundreds of community leaders from diverse backgrounds for a series of one-on-one discussions to help promote understanding of differences, build trust, and ultimately improve race relations. Holliday has been an outspoken critic of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but he says his Mosaic partnerships are not meant to deflect attention from the work of the commission. Rather, he believes that looking ahead and developing trusting relationships, two people at a time, offers more promise and less chance for divisiveness than looking backward and assigning blame. Make no mistake about it, this is sensitive territory Greensboro is heading into, and much is at stake, not the least of which could be the opportunity for Greensboro, not exactly on the nation's radar screen, to project a progressive reputation and a willingness to tackle crises head-on. An image like that could make the city more attractive for economic development. But it will be a long, difficult road from here to there, and progress, as always, will depend on one's perspective. There are many. Supporters of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission are not surprised that Greensboro leaders are leery of revisiting November 1979. But, they argue, unless the truth gets told, unity is impossible. Some black leaders insist that nothing is going to happen unless you grapple with an even longer history, like the scars left by slavery and the imbalance of power between blacks and whites that has always existed. Yet that starting point, no matter the merits, can be overwhelming to even the most liberal white people in the community. It's hard enough to tackle today's racial divide. How in the world do you confront centuries of discrimination before you toe the starting line? In Greensboro, advocates for the mayor's Mosaic partnerships believe you can't even begin to have those kinds of in-your-face discussions between blacks and whites until you develop enough relationships and raise the overall level of trust. That simply has to come first. As for the hornet's nest of 1979, leave it alone, they say. Let's move forward now, from this point in time. But here's what Greensboro's largely white power structure, which wants nothing to do with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, seems reluctant to grasp. Hundreds of Greensboro residents remember that tragic November day. Many of them witnessed the violence, and even though television cameras caught the shootings on film, there were no criminal convictions. Later, the city of Greensboro and the police department were both found complicit in a civil trial, but no apology or explanation has ever been offered. And that's the rub. Too many Greensboro residents, mostly black, are still angry, still hurting, even 25 years later. So what's the hope for improving race relations in Greensboro? Well, maybe, just maybe, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Mosaic Partnerships can complement each other. Maybe the truth that emerges from the commission will become the topic of conciliatory discussions among the Mosaic partners. Maybe healing and progress can take place simultaneously. If so, Greensboro has a chance not only to live up to, but to embellish its historical legacy of tolerance and civil rights.